Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. This continues the narrative of King Aswapati's spiritual development. Last week, I think we started on page 76 at the break, and we read two sections. We just read them. And then we started to read again at line 85 on page 76. Did we reach the break on page 78? We read to the break on page 78, and then we went back and had a look. So where do we have to start again now?
146.
Line 146. Yeah, this is a very important section. I mentioned it last week. That on the basis of that secret knowledge which has been revealed to Aswapati and to us in the previous canto, now Aswapati conceives this hope immense, this will. He conceives the idea of a superhuman form. And he wants to discern that. He raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights. This was, of course, an important moment in Sri Aurobindo's own development. I think it is in his evening talks that he reveals that when he was in Alipur jail, over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, the spirit of Swami Vivekananda visited him every night and explained to him the knowledge which Mother has illustrated in that sketch and painting which we have on display today of the different planes of existence, all the many planes of existence. She herself had explored those planes when she was studying in Algeria with Théon and Madame Théon. And she's explained to Huta how it was possible for her to exteriorize her consciousness first from the material body into the vital body and then beyond the vital body into a series of mental bodies and even higher. She said she could do it 13 times. And reach that borderline between the manifestation and the transcendent state. That's what she's illustrated in that sketch and the painting that Huta has done. So this is the hope and the will that now seizes King Aswapati's heart. He's had so many wonderful experiences in the course of his yogic development, the goddesses of revelation and intuition and discernment and wisdom, they have revealed many things to him in glimpses. But now he feels that the glory he had glimpsed must be his home. And not only his home, it must be a greater world for all. No? So do we want to read this again? Yes? So we'll start on this side. Patty, would you read, please, page 76 at the break?
A will, a hope immense, now seized his heart. And to discern the superhuman form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual height, aspiring to bring down a greater world. The glory he had glimpsed must be his home, a brighter, heavenlier sun, must soon illumine this just room with its dark internal stare. The infant soul in its small nursery school, did objects meant for a lesson hardly learned outgrow its early grammar of intellect, and its imitation of earth nature's art, its earthly dialect to God language change, in living symbols study reality, and learn the logic of the infinite. The ideal must be nature's common truth, the body illumined with the indwelling God, the heart and mind feel one with all that is, a conscious soul live in a conscious world.
So we read this and we looked at this last week. If anybody has any questions about this, this is now the great will and hope and aspiration which is going to carry King Aswapati through all the rest of his journey, his travels through the plains of existence, and his meeting, eventual meeting, with the Supreme Divine Mother.
Line 91, what is the dark internal stair?
For me, it's a lovely image Shobindo's using of those Victorian houses, like the one where he grew up in Manchester, which have a main stairway for the house, the family and the guests. But there's a dark internal stair which is meant for the servants and the children. And the children have a room there on that stairway, which is the nursery school. And of course, that dark internal stair, it's not so brightly lit, but it does lead right up to the very top of the house. There's another wonderful story set in this same period, which has a similar image, that there's this secret stair leading up, and there in the very topmost attic is the grandmother, the secret grandmother, who is really our mother, young and old, and who can tell the secrets and give protection. So it's something like that. In us, it's this this way up from our lower levels up to our highest levels that we hardly know about. It's a kind of secret. So we'll just read on. Naren?
As through a mist a sovereign heat is seen, briefness of the eternal spirit appeared, exiled in a fragmented universe, amid half semblances of divine things. These now which serve no more his regal town, the immortal sprite refused the doom to live, a miser of scanty bargain made, between our littleness and bounded hopes, and the compassionate his height repelled the lowness of earth's state, a wideness discontented with its frame, resiled from poor ascent to nature's terms, the harsh contract spurned and diminished these.
Thank you. So as if he's seeing a tremendously high mountain peak through mist, he sees the greatness of the eternal spirit and saw how that spirit expresses itself here in our material universe, exiled from its pure transcendent spiritual state. It's here in this fragmented universe where the spirit is broken up and represented imperfectly in so many appearances, half semblances of diviner things. And he, Aswapati, can no longer feel satisfied with that. The realizations that he's had that have given him this freedom and greatness of the soul, it's just not good enough, no? That he feels his immortality and he thinks, why do I have to live in this human way, a miser of the scanty bargain made between our littleness and bounded hopes and the compassionate infinitudes. We read about it also in the essays on the Gita. We read about it earlier in Savitri. This dark agreement which is ruling the soul and the spirit and all of us here in this material universe. And now his soul and his spirit revolts against that, no longer wants to accept this scanty bargain. It resiled, it wants to withdraw from this contract, from this agreement. Justin, would you read?
On the beginnings are accomplished here. Our basis matter seems alone complete. An absolute machine without a soul, or all seems a misfit of half ideas. Or we settle with the vice of every forms, a hurried and perfect glimpse of the heavenly things, gases and travesties of sinful form times. Here chaos sorts itself into a world, a brief formation drifting in the void, apings of knowledge, unfinished arcs of power, flakes of beauty into every shapes, love broken lattices of unity, swim fragmentary ruins of a floating sun, a packed assemblage of crude tempted lives are pieced into tessellated whole.
Yes, so a series of images about the kind of life we live here, based on matter, where everything seems incomplete, ill-fitting together, without harmony. Only this base of matter seems in a way complete, but it appears to us like an absolute machine without any soul in it. We see all this misfit of half ideas, half realized ideas. Or we might even get a glimpse of heaven, a hurried, imperfect glimpse of heavenly things. And then we try to fix them in an earthly form. In this world, chaos sorts itself into a world, some kind of semi-orderly arrangement, a brief formation drifting in the void, in the emptiness. There's something like knowledge, but it's not real knowledge, only an imitation of it. There seems to be something like power, but that power is not all-powerful, it's not fulfilled. There are wonderful flamings of beauty into earthly shapes. We do get glimpses of love, love's broken reflexes of unity, the oneness of true love broken up into many little fragments that are mirrored on water like an image, a broken up image of a sun, a high, glorious sun. Here in our world, there's this packed assemblage of crude, tentative life. Here we all are doing our best, but it's very imperfect in our world. No? Pieced together into some kind of whole, as if many, many small pieces have been put together. It's not really a whole. Right.
There is no perfect answer to our hopes. There are blind, voiceless doors that have no key. Thought climbs in vain and brings a borrowed light, cheated by counterfeits sold to us in life's mart. Our hard clutch are the forfeited heavenly bliss. There is provender for the mind's satiety. There are thrills of the flesh, but not the soul's desire. Here, even the highest rapture time can give is a mimicry of ungrasped beatitude, of mutilated statue of ecstasy, a wounded happiness that cannot live, a brief felicity of mind,
her saints thrown by the world power, to her body slave, her
simulacrum.
Or a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance.
That's where we stopped last time, I think. So let's look at this passage which Ravi read. It's a description of our earth life and experience with many subtle suggestions. We have high hopes, but we've got used to the fact that there's no perfect answer to them. We can't expect all our high hopes to be fulfilled. We often seem to find our way forward blocked by closed doors, blind doors. There's no indication on them where they're leading. They don't tell us anything. They have no key. Simply they are blocking our way. The thought tries to reach higher knowledge. What it brings to us is a borrowed light, some reflected light, like the moon's light instead of the sun's. Our hearts are always reaching out, longing for that heavenly bliss which we have lost when our souls accepted to incarnate in the material world. And because there's that longing, like children, we are ready to buy or get hold of, we want to have these counterfeits, these forgeries and imitations that are sold to us in the market of life. For a moment we are happy with them, but then we realize this is not the real thing. This is only a counterfeit. We can't reach that heavenly bliss we have lost. Here in the world, there's lots of provender for the mind, enough to stuff our minds full. Satiety is when you are completely full, you can't eat anything more. But it's not the real thing. It's not really nourishing and satisfying, all that mental stuff that is available to us. It's provender. Provender is the food you give to animals. There are thrills of the flesh, but they can't satisfy the soul's desire. So even the highest rapture that time can give is only a mimicry, a copy of the blissful states we cannot reach. It's like an image, a statue of ecstasy. But even that statue is mutilated. It's lost its arms, perhaps its head, like one of those old Greek statues. It's a mutilated statue of ecstasy. That even that highest rapture that time can give is a wounded happiness that cannot live. It comes to us as a brief felicity, short-lived happiness of the mind or the senses. That's what nature gives us. She throws to us. We are her body slaves. She can give us or not give us whatever she wants. Or, he says, it's a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance. The seraglio, I think the Turkish word is saray. In the Sultan's palace, there was this special section, the saray, where all his wives and concubines lived. And they lived in great luxury, and I'm sure they had wonderful things to eat and beautiful clothes and jewels and perfumes, and they were perfectly safe, protected there. But that delight was enforced on them. They were slaves. They were not free. So nature does that to us. She makes us enjoy things that are not necessarily good for our souls. Is it clear? Anybody wants to ask anything?
Simulacrum.
A simulacrum. Yes, it's something that looks just like. But it's not the real thing. A facsimile. Nowadays we talk about facsimiles.
Shall we go on?
Don, are you ready to go on? You don't have to read. Amitor is going to read. But you and Marianne seemed very occupied with something else.
No, I was talking about the seraglios.
Seraglios, yeah. Okay. Oh, yes. Thank you. We have to labor very hard in this world, but all we have acquired, whatever gains we make, soon loses worth. It doesn't keep its value. We may think we've piled up some achievements in stored in the bank of time, but they're not gaining value. They are losing worth. No? They're becoming old, disvalued credits in time's bank, imperfections check drawn on the inconscient. What is it worth? We make all these efforts, but following behind them like a shadow, can't be detached, is unpredictable things, inconsequence. We don't know what are going to be the consequences of our actions. If we try to form a little cosmos of harmony in our lives, in our work, relationships, chaos is just waiting to take it over, to disintegrate it. So Asvapati sees all that. He saw the doubtfulness of all things here, how uncertain and unpredictable and unreliable everything is. The incertitude of man's proud, confident thought. We think we've got it all worked out, but we haven't. All the achievements of humanity, they pass in time. They're transient. Man, each of us, is a thinking being in an unthinking world. An island in the sea of the unknown. One of the great English poets has written, "No man is an island." And that may be the underlying truth, but we feel like islands, don't we? We may be in contact with some other islands, but here we all are in the sea of the unknown. Each of us is a smallness, trying to be great, greater than we are. Each of us is an animal with some instincts of a god. This is our problem. If we were just animals, we'd just be animals. But there are these instincts of a god in us which want us to be much more. That's what makes things difficult for us. And all of us have more or less the same story. Our lives are a story too common to be told. Our deeds, our actions, our achievements, when we add them all up, the sum is nothing, naught. A kind of torch, a light of consciousness is lit in each of us. But then we have to die, and that torch gets quenched. What is the use of it? Our highest hope is this star. Maybe there's a guiding star which is with us throughout our lives, from our birth, from the time when we're in the cradle, until we're laid in the grave. Perhaps some guiding light is with us. That's our hope. Yes.
In Entretien, 1957-58, was said the man is animal in progression.
In progression, yes. We're evolving animals, yes.
Yes, but it's very interesting description of what is
Yes. Yes.
The line 158, it says an animal with some instincts of God.
Of a God.
Of a God. Where mother explains, I think it's surely explains another word where it says, we are one foot in humanity, another foot in animality, and yet we are the candidates for divinity.
For divinity, yes. So there are some divine instincts in human beings. The mother's also talked about this, the fact that there is a soul, that there's a psychic being, and that the instincts, divine instincts, are there. She says that's the saving grace of humanity. It's there in every human being. It's often covered up, very heavily covered up, by the animality. But it is there. A god, yes, means not a god in the sense of the god, the lord and creator and all, not the, a god in the sense of a cosmic power, but a divine being, a soul.
Like representing some power. I mean, there are different gods representing different powers, let's say, and one of the powers maybe is...
Each of us is representing a unique power of the divine. And sometimes he calls it Godhead, an individualized form of divinity.
Instinct means the...
An instinct, yes, an instinct. That's what nature puts into animals, to guide them.
Automatic action.
Yeah. But they just, they have some inner guidance that just tells them the right thing to do. So in the same way, we've got some kind of divine instinct in us. Some. And perhaps that's the best part of us, those instincts.
Does she or Lindo say something about, or animals have some instincts of God too, animals themselves?
Perhaps this is really what distinguishes humanity from the animals. We have an animal body and we have animal instincts and... The scientists, the biologists, they tell us that we are actually naked apes. No? But Sri Aurobindo and mothers tell us we're not only that. No? We are animals, okay, but we are animals with an instinct and a drive to be something more than just an animal.
But if the animals have a psychic being, they must surely have some connection with the divinity within themselves.
Yes, it's a different level of development of the psychic being. No? Surely we've all been animals, I mean purely animals. And I must have told you before the story about Mother who, when she came to Sri Aurobindo in Pondi, there was at least one dog and there were several cats. And she was interested to see how far by the higher influence, the influence of the higher consciousness, she could help those animals to develop their consciousness. And would she be able to help one or more of those animals to be ready to take a human birth the next time they incarnated? So it seems that she felt she was successful in at least one case. She said, maybe not the most developed human being, but still, he took a human birth.
Cat or the dog?
It was a cat, I think.
And that cat came back to her darshan in later days, as a human.
As a human, yes. Yeah.
Actually, there are several stories about the mother
Yes.
I don't recall them all. But
there's a little book about these cat stories. There was one cat who always used to sit on Sherbindo's chair and would go into meditation there. So Sherbindo wouldn't disturb it. Mother said that cat was truly meditating. Whether that's the one who took a human birth or not, I don't know. But anyway, if we believe this picture we're given of this endless chain of existence with different levels of development, it's clear that we are very close to the animals. And domestic animals often show some kind of aspiration to be more like us. Or sometimes they are just watching us. They're so puzzled. What is she doing? You know, what is that? What did you want to say, Don?
This morning, just by accident, in perfect tune to what we're just now talking about, it was a video from the 1930s of a fire group, firefighters and so on there, who had a pet cat. And when the fire bell rang, they all ran and slid down the pole. The
cat would also go with them.
So the cat went in the truck with them, and evidently didn't show that, but evidently did something to help with the fire. But then unfortunately, it missed the pole at one point.
Fell to its death.
Passed away. But the video of it actually sliding down the pole and chain, running after and getting into the truck of the fire thing, it was part of what they were. Firefighters. Amazing.
We've seen a very touching video of two wild cats in the street, stray cats in the street. And one of them got hit by a car, actually was killed. And how the other cat stayed with it, pulled the body somehow to safety, and stayed with it for many hours. So then you can say that's a more than purely animal instinct. It's the beginning of something else. So there's no breaks in this chain. All the links are there.
There's a gradation of consciousness. Like in human beings, we have gradations of consciousness. In animals, also there.
So now let us read this last sentence. Asvapati sees all this inadequacy of human beings, but he also sees something else. Rosa, you please read it.
His hope is still missing.
Yes, next line.
And yet a later destiny may be his, for the eternal spirit is his too. He can recreate himself and all around and fashion new.
Thank you. This is about us. This is about human beings. This is true for each and every one of us. A greater destiny may be ours, for the eternal spirit is our truth. We can recreate ourselves and all around and fashion new the world in which we live. We, ignorant, are the knower beyond time. We are the self above nature, above fate. As long as we live in our human nature, we are subject to the laws of nature, we are subject to fate. But since within us there is the eternal spirit, there is the possibility for that to change, for us to find out who we really are and make that eternal spirit the acting center of our life and our action. That's what the mother asks us to do. So seeing all this, Asvapati's soul takes a great decision, and that's described in what comes next. So Danya, you will read. Yes.
We
We haven't read this. I thought we read to the bottom of the break on page 80. Maybe even to page 83. We read to page 83, yes. So now let's look at this. Sudhanya, please.
His soul returned from all that he had done. First was a futile deal of human toil, forsaken within the circle of the days, in distance and the crowded tramp of life. The silence was his sole companion left. Impassive, he lived immune from upheaval. A figure in the ineffable witness shrine, facing the vast cathedral of his thought, under its arch dim with infinity, and heaven was brooding of invisible wings. A call was on him from intangible height. Indifferent to the literal outpost wine, he dwelt in the wideness of the eternal rain. His being now exceeded thinking pace. His boundless thought was never to cosmic sight. A universal light was in his eyes, a golden influx flowed through heart and brain. A force came down into his mortal limbs, a current from eternal seas of bliss. He felt the invasions and the nameless joy. All of his occult omnipotent souls, allured by the omniscient ecstasy, a living center of the
illimitable. Illimitable. Please go on.
Widened to equate with the world's circumference, he turned to his immense spiritual fate.
No, let's pause there. He turned to his immense spiritual fate. This is a crucial step, no? When the soul steps back from everything that it's done, detaches itself completely from the futile din of human toil, all this noise and labor. So the days are just wheeling by. He's abandoned them, forsaken. It's as if that sound of the tramp of human life retreats to a vast distance. He can hardly hear it anymore. He's alone with the silence. He goes on living, but he's living immune from earthly hopes. They can't influence him anymore. It's as if he's moving, pacing about in a vast cathedral, a cathedral of his higher mind. This is the shrine of the witness, the Purusha, stepping back and watching. And that vast cathedral, its arches go up so high, they become dim with infinity, the eye can't follow them. And there are winged souls perhaps, mounting upwards or brooding, ready to give birth to something here on earth. He's felt a call from those heights, those intangible, unreachable heights. So he's no longer interested in this little outpost mind here. He's living in a much vaster space, the wideness of the eternal's reign. And his own conscious being has widened so that it's exceeding thinkable space, beyond the reach of the mind. His thought has widened and become very close to a universal vision, cosmic sight. A universal light was in his eyes, and he experiences this flow of golden light and power into his brain and his heart, force coming down into the body, which is a current from eternal seas of bliss. He experiences that force coming into him and that light, the invasion, the nameless joy it begins, it brings. So he's become aware of his source, his occult, hidden, all-powerful source. And he's attracted by that omniscient ecstasy, the all-knowing Ananda. He recognizes that he himself has become a living center of the illimitable one. And his being is widened to equate with the circumference of the world. So in that state, he turns to his immense spiritual fate. He's leaving behind all the futile din of human toil. He's taking on a huge adventure, his immense spiritual fate.
Shall I?
Mm.
May I ask a question a little bit back?
Sure. Yes.
It's about the previous 1964. Now we're reading about Aswapatina.
Yes.
And in that part, last time, you said that 157 years go back to the human being. And then from 1964.
Yes. It's on page 64.
Yeah, and yet the greater destiny may be his.
Oh, yes.
And my question is, the word name, will be his name, where is name?
It's a possibility.
So it is not more than a possibility, because when I did it now, I forgot it.
It's on page, you mean here on page 78, line 163. There's his hope is a star above a cradle and a grave, and yet a greater destiny may be his. Yes, it means we are not bound completely to this limited fate where all we have is a star above a cradle and a grave and everything we've done loses worth. That's what our human life looks like, but that we have a higher possibility than that. A greater destiny can be ours, maybe. It means there's that possibility is there for us, for each of us, because for each of us, the truth of our being is not this limited state. It's the eternal spirit, and that's really true for each of us. Well, no, it depends on us to a certain extent whether that possibility gets realized. How much effort are we going to put into it? No, I think this is also individual. Each of us have this possibility. Yes, yeah. Of course, it's the destiny of the human race, but our effort, our will, our choice is important in bringing that about. It depends on each of us how much we can contribute to this forward movement.
As far as I know from Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, each of us will reach there. It may take different time lengths. It may take different time, but it's sure, it's not me. It is sure that we reach there.
But here, Tara was asking about why this word may is there. And what I want to say is that it indicates we have a possibility of choice. It's not just a possibility. It's in a way up to us.
Potential is there. Realization.
Yes.
Potentially you have it. But if you want to realize it, it's a choice. Then you have to work for it, and it may also not come. Yeah,
but I think what I'm contradicting him is that according to Sri Aurobindo, at my stage of evolution, it may be made, but ultimately every soul has to.
That's the divine intention,
yes.
That it shall be for all,
how many
for everything.
Depends on you.
Well, it doesn't even depend entirely on us, but it's a potentiality and has to flower, like in every little seed. there's the potentiality of a particular plant. Is that potentiality going to be realized? That depends on many factors. No. Yes.
This idea of potentiality, you plant the seed, it's going to grow to whatever that is going to be. But each of our potentialities, if we are born with a little bit of ranting, the potential is different for each of us.
Yes, each of us carries a unique potential realization.
This makes, I don't know what it is.
But none of them are limited.
Eh?
All, essentially, the potential is infinite in every case, but different, unique.
Yeah.
That's what's so marvelous. As if each of these seeds represents a unique possibility of the one, the infinite one. So Asvapati has recognized the great possibility that the universe offers him, and he's going to do his utmost to take advantage of it, no? Yes.
The first sentence of this part, of this paragraph, is his soul retired from all that he had done. I understood it well after that, and I understood it well, if I understood that well. There is a description of Asvapati. In another state. He comes in another state. Is that in that state, that's my question, is that a state with a retired soul?
No, it means the soul withdraws. So it's no longer identified with all this earthly din and human toil and all that. It's recognized that there's another possibility. And so it withdraws from everything it's been doing so far, and it takes another status. The status of being one or companioned by the silence, becoming moving in this ineffable witness shrine, aware. It says he becomes aware of his source and therefore of his immense spiritual possibilities. And in future, he's not going to be focusing on anything that he's done so far. Although he's been a great king, he's going to be focusing on that, and above all on this aspiration to bring down a greater world. So it's not only for himself. The soul has taken a different poise. This is what has to happen for us also. We were reading about it, I think, in the Thursday class, the way that for a long time the individual soul, which is really the Lord himself, just agrees to be whatever nature wants him to be. We are in that state, no? But nature is pushing us to a point where we don't have to be subject to her. The soul can become free of the compulsions of nature. And that's what's happened to King Asvapa. He's realized this possibility, and now he's going to take advantage of that. So it's the soul steps back. No, doesn't it say that? When did we read it just recently? Yeah, we just read that now, but on Thursday we read it. Sorry, can't find it. It's about the soul and how it's the subject of nature until one day it wakes up and remembers who it really is and what its real scope is. So that's a crucial moment in its development. And that's what's happening to Asvapati now. Yeah, of course it's repeated here, but I'm just trying to face this. It's on page 65. It says that about he, the soul, is dependent on nature. He can't do anything without her. She's ruling him still, even when he thinks he's her master. But at last he wakes to a memory of self. He sees within the face of deity. The Godhead breaks out through the human mold. Her highest heights she unmasks and is his mate. Till then, he is a plaything in her game. So we can each of us look and see where we are, no? Whether we're still a plaything or whether we have remembered who we really are. Yes?
He seems to withdraw from action and telling me still about karma yoga.
Action isn't only outward action. I mean, Mother said this in the beginning of Auroville, then she stopped saying it because she saw people weren't really understanding her. She said, if people are really doing spiritual work, then they don't necessarily have to do manual labor. Yeah, so they will be helping to build the city in another way. But I think very few of us are at that point yet. For most of us, what she says in To Be a True Aurovillian, to deal with matter, do some material work every day, that helps us to progress and helps matter to progress. The best thing is if you can do both at the same time. That's really karma yoga. Like you're washing dishes in the dining room and at the same time you're in communication with the divine and you're doing the inner work at the same time. I think that that's what's really meant by karma yoga.
May I add something?
Yes.
About this image of center and circumference.
Ah, yes.
The fact is from Pascal's past French, Blaise Pascal. He was a mystic as well, and in his thoughts, his book about it, he presents God as a figure of circle, having centers everywhere and circumference nowhere. So he images his entire from circumferences. Circle goes in center, he's center here.
Yeah.
So it's an image of being concentrated.
Yeah, it comes actually several times in Savitri.
Yes.
About the center of infinity. If there's no limits, how can there be a center? In fact, if there's no limits, every point can be a center. So each individual can be a living center of the illimitable. That's how he is living. He feels himself at the center of this infinite possibility. He's a living center. Each of us can be a living center of the illimitable.
But was I Jean-Baptiste explained, he lost his center, but not for her, but for the earth. It's very experience of the Jean-Baptiste somehow. And also, when I listen to Mother Marmou, I'm very touched with something. When I pray to the divine, I never tell in my prayer manifest what I pray, what I not want, but when I offer to the divine or the supreme. It's very, very, very important.
Shall we stop there for today? He turned to his immense spiritual fate. We're stopping there at page 79, line 193. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.